Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Donna Smith of the California Nurses Association, who explains why she believes the recently passed House health care reform bill falls far short of what's needed to provide citizens with comprehensive, quality care and control skyrocketing costs. Erin Mattson of the National Organization for Women, who discusses the anti-abortion amendment adopted in the House health care reform bill and what pro-choice groups are doing to fight back. And Carl Frisch with the group Media Matters for America, who examines the corporate media spin on the November 3rd local and state election results. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Dalai Lama greeted over 30,000 Buddhist followers on November 8th in the Himalayan town of Tawang, India, under tight security. The visit was engulfed in controversy as Tawang is a center of regional Buddhist culture and the focal point of a long border dispute between China and India. China reportedly tried to get India to cancel the visit, but India Prime Minister Manmohan Singh refused, saying the Dalai Lama is an honored guest. The Dalai Lama last visited Tawang in 2003. The visit increased tensions between India and China, which have worsened in recent months related to the ongoing dispute over the 2,000-mile frontier. China has challenged development projects to the province, and India has mobilized over 30,000 troops on the disputed border. Tensions are also rising because the Dalai Lama has experienced health problems, raising ongoing questions about who would succeed him as the leader of Tibetan Buddhism. Since 2002, hundreds of midwives have been trained to go door-to-door throughout Afghanistan to improve women's health in places with scarce electricity or clean water. Afghanistan is at the bottom of international rankings of human health and development. According to the Christian Science Monitor, 60% of Afghans had no access to health care services 7 years ago. Moreover, two-thirds of all health districts provided no maternal or child health services. According to a study by the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, only 10% of Afghan hospitals had the equipment to perform cesarean deliveries. Today, there are over 2,400 trained midwives in Afghanistan who went through a two-year program funded primarily by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Meanwhile, fear has grown among women activists in the midst of an increasingly hostile political environment. In mid-April, Sitara Achakzia, a member of the Kandahar Provincial Council, was shot and killed after giving an interview to the United Nations Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, which was investigating rising violence against women. In July, President Hamid Karzai approved the Shiite Personal Status Law, sometimes known in the Western media as the Marital Rape Law. The measure, pushed by religious conservatives, forbids women to marry without permission and legalizes forced marriage. The law also considers the rape of a woman or a minor outside of marriage to be a property crime with restitution to the father or husband, rather than a crime of violence against a victim. Cameron Willingham was executed in February 2004, 12 years after being convicted of killing his three young children in a fire at his Texas home. In August, the International Association of Fire Safety Service concluded there was no evidence that Willingham had deliberately set the fire that killed his children. The Texas Forensic Science Commission is continuing to review the case. According to the news magazine In These Times, all jurors in death penalty cases must be death-qualified by pledging to morally support capital punishment. Recent research shows that death-qualified jurors tend to be more conservative than the general public and display authoritarian personality traits. These jurors are more likely to follow established rules and believe harsh measures are needed to control criminals. Psychologist and trial consultant Brooke Butler has found that death penalty jurors are more likely to see the world as black and white and to dismiss mitigating circumstances. They may also downplay mental illness as a legitimate defense. Butler told In These Times, death-qualified jurors are likely to be male, Caucasian, politically conservative, Catholic or Protestant, and middle class. The Texas Forensic Science Commission, investigating the evidence that sent Cameron Willingham to his death, may issue a report next spring finding professional negligence or misconduct, but won't deliver an opinion on his guilt or innocence. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
In a narrow late-night victory on November 7th, House Democrats and one lone Republican passed a health care reform bill by a margin of 220 to 215. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi compared passage of the bill to the establishment of the Social Security Act in 1935 and the Medicare Act in 1965. Central elements of the Affordable Health Care for America Act include a mandate for most Americans to purchase health insurance with a provision of subsidies. It prohibits insurers from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, caps the financial responsibility of insured individuals faced with serious illnesses and medical emergencies, and prevents insurance companies from abandoning policyholders when they get sick. The measure includes a public health insurance option that would be required to negotiate with providers, as opposed to the more cost-saving position of reimbursing providers using Medicare rates. As advertised, the bill would cover 36 million uninsured Americans at a cost of just under $900 billion over 10 years. A controversial amendment added to the bill that prohibits federal funds from being spent for abortion services within the public option and in the insurance exchange is examined later in this program. The debate now moves to the U.S. Senate, where any health reform bill passed there must be merged with the House version. Donna Smith is a community organizer and legislative advocate with the California Nurses Association. She and her husband were profiled in Michael Moore's documentary film, Sicko, which examined the urgent need for U.S. health care reform. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Smith about why she believes the recently passed House reform legislation falls far short of what the country needs to provide citizens with comprehensive quality care and control skyrocketing costs.
My fear is that we pass something that, first of all, will not really improve the situation for access to health care for so very many people who need it desperately. If the House version of health reform legislation were to be ultimately enacted into law, certainly we'd have purchase mandates so that all of us would have to purchase private insurance if it was not offered through our employers, and we'd have to purchase it out through the exchange set up by the federal government, and a lot of citizens in New England and Massachusetts certainly would be familiar with that kind of a purchasing scenario. There are some limited things about the bill that could be helpful to some people who have not been able to get insurance in the past. For instance, the much-touted removing pre-existing condition clauses and forbidding insurance companies from rescinding your policy simply because you get sick. Those things might have some limited benefit to people who have not been able to get coverage. But obviously the concern for those of us who have been watching this legislation closely is that by creating 47 million more customers for the health insurance industry and massive gains for them in terms of revenue, it does nothing to alleviate the situation of denial of treatment when an insurance company feels like a treatment's too expensive or is not what would be in line with their bottom line. They can certainly still deny that treatment. There's nothing in the legislation that will prevent them from doing that. And also a big concern about the STUPAC amendment that passed, the limits on abortion funding that went well beyond what's already in place.
What about the public option? That's certainly been, for better or for worse, that's been the focus of a lot of the debate in the country and on Capitol Hill about where this health care reform legislation is going to go. The weekend public option put forward by Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats, it's not going to be available to most people in this country. I think only 2 or 3% of the population of the nation will be eligible to get it. And from what I understand, the Congressional Budget Office estimated it, the premiums for the public option that they were talking about may be even more expensive than private, similar health insurance policies.
Exactly.
So this seems to be a lose-lose situation if you look at just the outlines of what we know today. Things could change, but it doesn't look all that great.
No, it doesn't look great. And, you know, and this was always the position of the Nurses Association, the California Nurses Association, was that these that the congressional members started out with their weakest bargaining position instead of starting out with their strongest bargaining. The strongest and best way to solve the health care problem we have in this country is to go with a single-payer plan, which, by the way, does not mean the whole means of control of the delivery of the health care system rests with the government. Now, personally, for me, that'd be okay with me. I think the VA system operates very well, and that is a single-payer system in this country. Medicare is also a single-payer system, but it's a little bit different with Medicare. So many of your listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with Medicare. Many are probably on it. You know, interestingly, the public plan was supposed to be this robust plan, and what we ultimately ended up with was something very in a very weakened state that only, as you say, they asked the Congressional Budget Office estimates less than 2% of Americans under 65 will even be able to purchase the public option, and because the insurance companies didn't really want there to be any competition, and they really were very much in control of making sure the legislation looked like they wanted it to look, the public option isn't going to be able to provide that offsetting competition. Even if that were a possibility, it isn't going to be able to do that because of the way the legislation ultimately came down. So I think it's a great disappointment. When we jump over to the Senate side, we're going to get something that's going to look even weaker.
Donna, there are many who support the House of Representatives bill and looking to some compromise, final legislation that Barack Obama can sign into law. And they admonish us to not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, that incrementalism is probably the only way we pragmatically can get health care reform in this country. So we shouldn't throw out this effort, even though it's not perfect. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I can certainly understand that position. A lot of really good and dear people to me share that vision. And what I'm really looking for and have been looking for and wanted to look for from this Congress was efforts that moved us in the right direction. You know, if we couldn't get there all at once, let's get there moving in the right direction. And my problem now when I take a look at the legislation is I feel like there's the gaping holes that they left are those that are going to hurt families and working people the most. And that's what really worries me. We didn't move in the right direction. And that's troubling, very troubling to me. Nurses are never anxious to have anything that will move health care reform in the right direction be viewed in anything but a great light. This is problematic for us. This legislation does not give us the direction that we need in moving towards health care justice for every single American.
That was Donna Smith, a community organizer and legislative advocate with the California Nurses Association. Call the association at area code 510-273-2200. Or visit their website at guaranteedhealthcare.org. When the House of Representatives passed a health care reform bill, the measure included what some advocates of abortion rights call the most sweeping abortion restriction in 30 years. Negotiations in the House had been ongoing for months to maintain the status quo regarding no taxpayer funding for abortions, as enshrined in the 1976 Hyde Amendment, which denies poor women federal funding for abortions. But when House legislators adopted an amendment proposed by anti-abortion Democrat Bart Stupak of Michigan and Republican Joseph Pitts of Pennsylvania, they expanded the abortion ban to cover subsidized insurance policies which women buy with their own money. 64 Democrats voted with virtually all of the Republicans in favor of the amendment, which passed 240 to 194. The Conference of Catholic Bishops had lobbied hard for the Stupak-Pitts measure. Pro-choice advocates maintain that birth control and abortion are integral parts of women's health care needs and insist that health care reform should not be a vehicle to deny a woman's fundamental right to choose. Many of these groups are now pushing the Senate to pass a health care bill that does not adopt the Stupak-Pitts Amendment and are urging President Obama not to sign any health care bill that restricts women's reproductive rights. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Aaron Mattson, the Action Vice President of NOW, the National Organization for Women. She discusses what the Stupak-Pitts Amendment portends for reproductive services for millions of American women. And Mattson explains what NOW and like-minded groups are doing to fight back.
No additional restrictions on abortion in the health care package are necessary to specify that federal funds won't be used to pay for abortion. That said, the Stupak-Pitts Amendment, for the first time, would ban private insurance companies from covering abortion. what's going to happen here is women who receive subsidies for health care will be prevented from having abortion covered even with 100% of their own money that they give to private, profit-driven insurance companies, many of which currently offer abortion coverage, unless they purchase an additional abortion rider. It seems quite possible that women who are, in fact, not receiving any subsidies from the government at all in the form of tax credits would have to purchase an abortion rider on top of the coverage that they're paying for completely by themselves. That's absolutely ludicrous. Who has money to purchase an abortion rider? Who would even plan to need an abortion rider? Am I going to buy a cancer rider on my plan just in case I might get cancer?
So, Aaron Mattson, what's the next step for now and others who oppose the STUPAC amendment?
We weren't given the time to stop this in the way that we traditionally would. So immediately on Sunday, we planned a protest. I believe that we organized the first protest that's taken place outside the Russell Senate office building. We had so many people, we got kicked out by the police after 45 minutes. And what we are doing is we are organizing grassroots response around the country. It is focusing on a few things. Number one, we want to make it very clear to our senators that nothing like this can be a part of the Senate legislation that moves through. So we are targeting them intensely, not just the traditional calls and letters. We are urging now activists to go in delegations to speak with their senators, or if the senators aren't available, to speak even in the local district office with the staff person dealing with health care reform. We are urging now members to publicize the results of those meetings, whether it is we can count on you, we can't count on you, or we're not sure. We want to keep the heat up. Number two, we want to keep the heat on Congress at this point because there's a chance that this could come out in conference committee. We need to create a groundswell of support for that. Number three, we will move on to lobbying the White House at a certain point because, of course, President Obama would be the one who would sign the health reform package into law. So we want to make sure that that is not something that he will support. But number four, and this is really where NOW is unique, we want women on the sidewalks. We want women in front of state houses. We want women in front of district offices. We want women wherever they can be seen, over highway overpasses, in busy intersections, and we want demonstrations just like yesterday.
Of course, abortion opponents have been talking about ways for months to make sure public money would not be used to fund abortions. But during most of the debate, the goal seemed to be to maintain the existing restrictions. But then this amendment passed, which goes far beyond that. Do you feel blindsided by what happened?
This came through so quickly in the middle of the night on Friday, and then the vote took place late Saturday night. That is simply outrageous. I think women were betrayed. Immediately following this vote, one of the first things I did was take a look at the Democratic Party platform, and there's a line in there, and it said, at this point, of course, they were talking about the Bush administration. They said that we oppose the current administration's consistent attempts to undermine a woman's ability to make her own life choices and obtain reproductive health care, including birth control. We will never put ideology above women's health. Now, I think it's very clear that women were betrayed.
That was Aaron Mattson, Action Vice President of the National Organization for Women. Contact NOW by calling area code 202-628-8669 or visit their website at now.org. As the results of November 3rd's local and state elections poured into network and cable TV outlets, commentators were standing by to read the tea leaves of voter sentiment and what it could mean to the future of Democrats, which now control Congress. The only two governor's races of the night were won by Republicans. Chris Christie defeated incumbent John Corzine in New Jersey, and Bob McDonald beat Democrat Cree Deeds by a wide margin in Virginia. Two other elections being closely watched had very different results, with special elections for House seats both being won by Democrats. As expected, California Lieutenant Governor John Garamendi won the Northern California district formerly held by Democratic Representative Ellen Tauscher. But the special election in New York's 23rd district drew the most attention when, for the first time since 1871, a Democrat, Bill Owens, claimed victory over Conservative Party candidate Doug Hoffman and GOP moderate Deirdre Scozzafava. Although Scozzafava was the Republican candidate within days of the election, she threw her support to Owens after prominent national conservative activists, including former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin and right-wing talk show hosts Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, endorsed Hoffman. The overall election results were interpreted by many pundits as a clear victory for Republicans, signaling danger for Democrats in the 2010 midterm election and for Barack Obama if he should run for a second term in 2012. Some commentators blamed Obama and the Democrats' progressive agenda on health care and global warming for defeats in New Jersey and Virginia, although that view was not backed up by exit polling. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Carl Frisch, senior fellow with the group Media Matters for America. He examines the corporate media's spin in covering the November 3rd election results and the civil war brewing in the Republican Party.
Well, the one thing that is certainly true about the elections is that we learned that right-wing media figures and right-wing media outlets just ain't that good when it comes to election analysis. Back in 2001, in George W. Bush's first off-year election, when Democrats won the mayorship in Los Angeles that had been Republican for 8 years, and the governorship in New Jersey, which had been Republican for 8 years, and the governorship of Virginia, which had been Republican for several terms, Republicans, including the White House and various media figures, most notably at Fox News, people like Dick Morris and Morton Kondracki and others, Laura Ingraham, all said, you know, these are local races decided on local issues. They don't have an impact on the presidency or Bush, et cetera, et cetera. And now, almost 10 years later, in the first off-year election of President Obama's administration, they're spinning it quite differently. But what's more interesting, taking for a moment and putting aside the Fox News talk radio spin that this was all about Obama, it would eventually lead to the failure of his health care plans with no public option, which would, of course, be proven wrong not even a week later. Exit polling indicated that people were not voting for or against him when it came to these races. What's interesting to note is that Christie in New Jersey and McDonnell in Virginia rarely spoke about Obama, never really attacked him in any way, and tried to run a centrist bipartisanship message. Notably in Virginia, McDonnell, a very, very conservative man who has close ties to Pat Robertson, shed that image and ran down the middle for the bulk of the campaign. What about the races where people were campaigning against or for Obama's plans? The Democrats picked up that congressional seat out in California, which had been Ellen Tauscher's for several years. So that was, you know, getting one more vote in there. But in New York, that seat that hadn't been held by a Democrat in nearly 150 years, the Democratic candidate, Bill Owens, campaigned in support, at least for the last week, of health care reform with a public option. And the Conservative Party candidate ran a Glenn Beck-style campaign against everything Obama stood for, against health care with a public option, against any kind of government spending, and he was defeated. And those are the two races, really, that have any impact on what's happening in Washington. And there were several people on Fox that said this was the end of, you know, Obamacare, there would be no public option, et cetera. And yet, Bill Owens, in his first major vote in Congress, was able to vote for health care reform with a public option. I think everybody would be willing to admit, including media analysts, that most presidents don't keep their popularity as high as when they're inaugurated months after the fact. But what you don't hear when they're talking about his dip in polls, keep in mind he's still, you know, wildly popular in every region of the country except for the South, according to polls. What people don't talk about is progressive angst in polls when it comes to legislation.
Given that Barack Obama is certainly less popular than he was on Inauguration Day. And the spin of these election results really slanted towards creating this mythology that this was a referendum on his presidency and the Democrats are in big trouble for the 2010 midterm elections. How much of a self-fulfilling slant is that? And how much does this biased news coverage really influence public opinion?
In terms of this fantasy world, I think that right-wing conservatives who get their news from Fox and talk radio, they're going to believe this, and nobody's going to sway their opinion one way or the other. I can tell you, though, I think there won't be any self-fulfilling prophecy here because it was, I think, nipped in the bud with the passage of the health care bill in the House, regardless of any problems that progressives or conservatives might have with various aspects of it. There also wasn't that much longevity to the spin that was coming out of the elections on Tuesday. If nationalized races had gone to Republicans, we'd be talking about a different story. There really isn't something that would provide the longevity necessary to keep the notion that Republicans have somehow turned a page in the national dialogue.
There's a lot of advice, many pundits coming out talking about how Obama and the Democrats better move to the right here, lest they lose a lot of the independent voters that are crucial in the 2010 midterm elections. The conventional wisdom, it seems, here in 2009 and going back many years, is that the Democrats always have to move to the right, and Republicans are rarely questioned about them moving further to the right.
It's interesting to hear members of the media say that Obama and the Democrats in Congress are too liberal, especially when you consider that they're triangulating with only two sides of the triangle. If you look at health care reform, and I'm not advocating a position here, but if you look at health care reform, the progressive position is single payer. But rather than have a discussion about single payer, Obama came out in favor of a public option, and the media took that as the liberal point of view, even the liberal point of view was single payer. So it became a discussion of public option versus no reform. And the only way to compromise was to move to the right. But isn't he starting from a centrist point of view on all these big issues and moving to the right? In which case, shouldn't the right be moving to the left?
That was Carl Frisch, senior fellow with the group Media Matters for America. Contact the group at area code 202-756-4100 or visit their website at mediamatters.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.